From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made when Senator Elizabeth Warren announced her campaign for president. Behind the scenes, her team had debated how to roll out the campaign, hoping to get the maximum media exposure and the maximum return in campaign contributions, money. Warren had studied how Congressman Beto O'Rourke had raised $79 million to challenge Senator Ted Cruz in Texas. And here, Vanity Fair picks up the story this week. Quote, "The money primary already seems to have one provisional casualty, Elizabeth Warren. She appears to have made a rookie mistake by hiring a relatively large campaign staff, followed by a sluggish fundraising start. Her attempt to use the O'Rourke viral playbook, drinking beer in her kitchen live on Instagram, fell flat." End quote. Just like that, the pundits are saying that Elizabeth Warren hasn't shown the strength to be a top contender. She hasn't raised enough money. Meanwhile, Senator Bernie Sanders announced his campaign and piled up several million dollars nearly overnight, and the analysts agreed that this means Senator Sanders should be taken seriously, not because of his policy ideas necessarily or how he would lead the country, but whether he can raise a lot of money quickly. There's one man who's been railing about the system for years. He's one of the country's leading public intellectuals, and for a brief time 4 years ago, floated his own presidential campaign as a way to raise public awareness about the influence of money in American politics. Harvard professor Lawrence Lessig has long warned that we don't really have a representative democracy if a tiny number of wealthy Americans control who participates in politics. Lessig is coming to SUNY Geneseo as the keynote speaker for their Open Education Week this week, which aims to raise awareness of free and open sharing of educational resources. He's got a lot to say about that, and we've asked him to join us here to discuss a range of issues. We're thrilled to welcome Professor Lawrence Lessig to Connections. Thank you for taking the time. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Well, I suspect you think Vanity Fair, maybe your message is sinking in. They called it the money primary. And I wonder if maybe they're watching your TED Talks over the years or reading your books.
If only I believed in strong copyright, I could get some licensing fees from that.
It's an accurate way to describe the current phase of the presidential campaign, you think, the money primary?
It is. And I think it's a problem at the presidential level. I think it's a much bigger problem for Congress, because the reality is when presidents get elected, they're being pulled in a million directions and their vision usually is pretty clear. But members of Congress who spend 30 to 70% of their time raising money to fund their campaigns, but raising their money from 100,000 Americans, they are much more vulnerable to having agendas corrupted by this corrupt system for funding campaigns. And that's the problem I think we've got to solve immediately.
Well, your latest book, America Compromised, was reviewed by Norman Ornstein, a recent guest on this program, for the New York Times. And I want to read a little bit from his review of your book on the subject of Congress. And so I'll go ahead and quote that now. He writes, "For Congress, Lessig notes that the framers were deeply concerned about corruption, but rarely focused on the evils of individual quid pro quos. They worried about institutions, the danger of politicians becoming dependent on forces beyond the voters who elected them, or, as Madison wrote, the people alone. Congress, Lessig believes, is corrupt even though the overwhelming majority of Congress people are not," end quote. Can you elaborate on that theme?
Yeah, I think that we tend to think about corruption in very kindergarten-like ways, as if it's like good people and bad people. And I think the most dangerous corruption is the corruption of good people inside of corrupted institutions. And so America Compromises about a bunch of institutions like that. But the core paradigm case, in my view, is Congress, because I do think most members of Congress go to Washington for the right reason. You might not agree with their politics, but they go thinking they're going to make the world a better place. And then they find themselves in a system where the only way they can survive or their party can survive is to spend this extraordinary amount of time raising money from a tiny, tiny fraction of the 1%. So Madison, in that quote that Norm was offering, said that we would have a branch that would be, quote, dependent on the people alone. And by the people, he said in Federalist 57, quote, not the rich more than the poor. But what we've evolved is a system where members of Congress are dependent on the rich more than the poor, on this tiny, tiny fraction of the rich. And just because we know they're humans, even if they're not evil, we know that they're constantly affected by this awareness that what they do might affect their ability to raise money. And that is a corruption, even if it's not the corruption of criminal bribery.
I recently heard from someone in politics who disputed the notion that money in politics influences political leaders to sort of move their policy positions. And his contention is, yes, people in politics are concerned about the influence, the pernicious influence of money, but it's because of money's ability to confuse the populace, to confuse voters in various forms and public information campaigns, as opposed to, well, you know, these contributions are, quote, buying votes, et cetera. Do you buy that?
I certainly don't think that the contributions buy votes. So I don't think anybody goes in and says, I hear that you're opposed to, you know, single-payer health care. Let me give you $50,000 and then you'll support it. It's a much more subtle influence than that. And the influence is most important in the way it affects the agenda of members of Congress. So if you know as a member of Congress that if you work hard to deregulate Wall Street, you'll have tons of money pour into your campaign from Wall Street. It's not that Wall Street has bought you. You might actually agree with the idea of Wall Street being deregulated, but you're going to focus your energy in a way that helps you to raise money. And that dynamic, that kind of invisible shape-shifting to bring yourself to a place that helps you to raise money is a corruption of the process. Leslie Byrne, a Democrat from Virginia, describes that when she went to Congress, she was told by a colleague, quote, always lean to the green. And then she was quick to clarify, you know, he was not an environmentalist. And the point she's making is exactly what we should have to worry about. If you are spending your time, half your time, 70% of your time on the telephone, dialing people, asking them for money, and your staff is standing there priming you about what this particular person cares about. You know, this person's a tax lawyer and he's interested in better ways to shelter tax income, or this person's a developer and he's interested in ways to reduce the or increase the depreciation that might be affecting on buildings. You can't help but be affected by that knowledge in forming what you're going to say, how you're going to pitch your message. And unless these people are superhuman, or they're not human at all, or they're pathological, we know that that influence is going to drive them to behave differently. And that's the corruption we need to worry about.
Well, you mentioned Wall Street. OpenSecrets.org ran a story last month titled Kirsten Gillibrand Rejecting PACs, but Backed by Wall Street. And they write, quote, one potential source of controversy in a crowded Democratic field is Senator Gillibrand's close relationship with Wall Street. She reportedly reached out to financial executives to gauge support for a White House run earlier this month. A significant portion of the money Gillibrand has fundraised has come from the securities and investment industry, most of which are Wall Street firms. In the 2018 cycle, Gillibrand received more than $1.84 million from individuals and PACs combined within the industry, end quote. So, Professor Lessig, I haven't talked to Senator Gillibrand directly. I'm confident she would say, Wall Street doesn't own my vote. They don't own my decision making. And right now we're playing the game the way it's played by a lot of people, but they're not going to own my vote. But are you troubled by what I just read there?
Well, I'm troubled not so much because I'm troubled about Senator Gillibrand, but because I know that Americans would hear that story and they would think that Senator Gillibrand's judgment is being affected by Wall Street, whether it is or isn't. And this is a critical part to the story about corruption. The question is not just whether you think the money is affecting a decision of a member of Congress. The question is also whether you think the fact of the money being given in the way it's given is leading members of the public to become more cynical about what their government does. And the answer to that question is absolute and uncontroversial. We know absolutely that people listen to stories like this about where members of Congress get their money, and they draw from that the conclusion that these members of Congress are bending over backwards to make the funders happy. And so I think that rather than like questioning the integrity of Senator Gillibrand or anybody in this particular situation, what we need to start talking about are the kinds of solutions that would change that dynamic. And so what I think is more striking than the fact of a particular senator or a particular candidate choosing to take PAC money or not, or choosing to take only small contributions or not, what's more striking and more important than that is whether they are openly talking about the need to publicly fund public campaigns. Because until we change the way we fund by including public funding, and I support the idea of giving everybody vouchers that they could use to help fund campaigns, until we make that change, none of these other changes matter at all. I mean, look, I was a big supporter of Beto. I've known him since he went to Congress. I was excited when he ran for Senate. I thought he did the right thing by announcing he was not going to take any PAC money. I think that generated enormous excitement. But the world in which candidates don't take PAC money is not a world where corruption has been removed from Washington. The only way we remove the corruption from Washington is when candidates do not spend 30 to 70% of their time raising money from a tiny fraction of the 1%. And that's the dynamic we need to change. And what's so striking to me is that there are extremely few people running for president right now who are willing to be completely upfront about the need to change the way we fund congressional campaigns by saying openly and strongly that they support the idea of publicly funding public campaigns.
Well, on that subject of corporate PAC money, you're right. I mean, most Democrats especially, but many politicians, most Democrats, and certainly I think every presidential Democratic contender has said they're not going to take corporate PAC money. And a lot of the noise is, well, that's progress. Well, that's a big deal here because now it'll just be small contributions. Now they won't be beholden. You don't seem to think that that is that laudable.
No. I mean, I think it's laudable that they want to talk about the problem of money in politics. But it's cheap talk to say that the solution to the problem of money in politics is not to take corporate PAC money. I mean, you know, first of all, there's the kind of ironic fact that corporate PAC money is actually more moderate than small dollar contributions. I mean, you know, the reality is corporate PAC money is probably a moderating influence. But that's not to say I support the idea of there being corporate PAC money. But I don't think that eliminating corporate PAC money is going to do anything here. And I get so frustrated by politicians who talk about solutions that they know are not solutions because they don't have the courage to talk about the solutions that actually would be solutions. So, you know, when you talk about a Green New Deal, if you're not willing to talk about taxing carbon, then you're not being serious. If you're talking about money in politics and you're not willing to talk about public funding of public campaigns, you're not being serious. You might be playing to what your pollsters tell you the public needs to hear or avoiding the words that you know the public finds it hard to understand. But what we need are leaders who are willing to help America understand what changes would give us a government we could trust. And an essential part of that, the only way to be serious in doing that, is to talk about changing the way we fund campaigns by publicly funding public campaigns.
If you could, though, just answer for, I think, a significant number of probably our conservative listeners, but also just listeners who may view this as, well, I think you've got the script flipped here, which is to say, if Professor Lawrence Lessig and Evan Dawson are running for the same seat, and I, you know, favor allowing, you know, people to have backyard chickens, and you do not, well, everyone who wants backyard chickens or currently owns them is probably going to donate to my campaign. I'm not going to be swayed to change my position. It's the idea of the chicken and egg, which came first. The idea is you put your policies out there, and the people who support it are going to fund your campaign, as opposed to people fund your campaigns, and you say, okay, what do you want? I'm going to do that. And whether it's George Will or so many others who view money as speech, they view this as a case of, look, naturally people are going to contribute to campaigns and to political leaders and to candidates who profess to favor the views that they hold, that this isn't a case of influence, and that maybe what we need to do is not change the system, but simply educate the public here that if you think votes are bought, they're not bought. And if you think money is a pernicious influence, it's the other way around. Money just props up people who already hold these views in the first place. How do you counter that?
Well, it's important to distinguish between people who are saying we should get rid of money in politics and people who are saying we should reform the way money is raised in politics. Because I'm definitely in the second camp and I'm not in the first camp. And so I agree with you. There are many people who support candidates because they support the underlying policies of those candidates. And the policies are the policies of the candidates because that's what they believe, not because that's what money says. But the problem is when the people with the money represent a tiny, tiny fraction of the funders of campaigns, then we no longer have a democracy. We have a system where this tiny, tiny fraction is leveraging their wealth to steer candidates in a way, or even to elect candidates who happen to believe with them in a way that's unrelated to the public. So that's why when I talk about publicly funding campaigns, my favorite solution is a proposal, for example, a version of something that Ro Khanna from California has introduced, give every citizen a rebate of the first $50 of the taxes that we all send to Washington. I mean, not everybody pays income taxes, but we all pay at least $50 of some form of taxes to Washington. So let's give a rebate to those $50 in the form of a democracy voucher or a democracy coupon, whatever you want to call it. And then with those vouchers, you can fund congressional campaigns. So you could say, you want to run for Congress, I'm going to give you my $50 voucher. I'll split it, you know, $10 to you and $10 to you, and I'll wait to the general election to see who I want to give the balance to. Now, the point is, if every voter had those vouchers, then when candidates would raise money, they would be raising money from all of us, just like they, in principle, are trying to get the votes from all of us. And so they would be responding to what all of us cared about as opposed to what the tiniest fraction of the 1% care about. So I think money is an extremely important part of the democratic process, but it needs to be democratic. It needs to be money that we all are participating in contributing, and changing the way we fund campaigns is quintessentially about making sure we all are participants in that contribution system.
My guest is Harvard Law Professor Lawrence Lessig, author, one of the country's leading public intellectuals, and he will be at SUNY Geneseo's Open Education Week tomorrow night. His talk, 7:30 p.m. tomorrow in the Wadsworth Auditorium on Geneseo's campus. The talk, free and open to the public. Listeners, if you've got questions or comments as we talk about these and related subjects, you can call the program. It's toll-free, 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255. Or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. I'm going to get Neely on the phone first with Professor Lessig. Go ahead, Neely.
Hi, Evan. Thanks so much. Such an important conversation to have. I wanted to go back to your statement at the beginning of the show about the money Bernie Sanders' campaign claimed to have been able to raise overnight. I heard and have been unable to verify, and so I'm wondering if your guest can confirm that he actually didn't raise all that money in one day. In fact, they've been fundraising since the 2016 primaries. That money has gone into one account, and then once he officially declared, the money was simply moved over so they were able to claim that their coffers were full from all these small donations. I haven't been able to confirm if that's true or not, but I think it can speak to just the, the possibilities or lack thereof of raising, you know, millions and millions of dollars overnight from small contributions. Thank you very much.
All right, Neely, thank you. Go ahead, Professor.
So I don't know anything about whether that technique was used. But I think the more fundamental fact is nobody doubts, or nobody should doubt, that Bernie Sanders is being responsive to small contributors. I don't think that's an issue anybody would contest, as opposed to the question one might raise about someone like Kirsten Gillibrand, whose contributors might be more concentrated. But again, I think both of those questions about Kirsten Gillibrand or about Bernie Sanders are missing the more fundamental question, which is, what are they promising they will do to bring about a change in the way Congress responds to the people? Because that's the core problem, Congress. It's not the president. I know if Bernie Sanders were elected president, I wouldn't have to worry about oil companies, or I wouldn't have to worry about insurance companies having enormous influence on him. But I sure as hell would be worried about oil companies having an influence on Congress people as they were deciding whether to support the Green New Deal, or insurance companies having an influence on Congress people as they were deciding whether to support single-payer health care. That would be the influence that would actually determine whether Bernie Sanders could achieve the policy objectives he's trying to achieve. So the question for Sanders is not so much, how much of the money did you actually raise in small contributions in a 12-hour period? The question for him is, how are you going to make sure Congress is responsive to the people and not to the big money? And my frustration with Bernie Sanders has been his unwillingness to put right out in front the most important change that we could make tomorrow, which is to publicly fund public elections. When he's been asked about this that I've heard, he's talked about doing this is, quote, something for the long term. And my response to that is, well, when is the long term? Because if we don't do this now, none of the things that he's talking about are even serious, because we know the way money can block change in Congress. So I'm sure he's got all the virtues there are in the world about these issues. But he's not the king. The president is not the only policymaker. The president has to work with Congress. And if Congress is corrupted by the influence of money, then nothing the president wants to do is going to be able to get through that corrupted institution.
Ray writes to the program and asks this question. He says, "We should change the game now in our state. Support the Fair Elections New York legislation for the small donor matching funds to publicly finance our New York elections." He says, "For every $1 of citizen campaign funding, $6 in public money would be added. It's in the state Senate and the Assembly right now. A statewide coalition of groups was lobbying in Albany for it last week. It could be done by April 1st. What does your guest think of it? Are you aware of it?" That's from Ray. Go ahead, Professor.
Absolutely aware of it. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful reform for a state like New York. It mirrors what goes on in the city of New York, where public funding, matching funds have been used in the city of New York for many years. And it's a little obscure just how significant that is because, you know, New York has produced mayors like Mayor Bloomberg, and you think this is not a mayor who's been produced by publicly funded campaigns. But it's had a dramatic effect in increasing the number of women and minorities who can be elected because they don't depend on having big Rolodexes, which is the word we old people use to talk about large address book files, of rich people to call on to fund their campaigns. Now, you know, New York was a leader in this matching fund innovation. Seattle has, I think, done them one better, which is Seattle has now adopted a system where every voter gets vouchers that they can use to fund campaigns. And what we know from the early returns from that system is that it increases substantially the number of middle class and lower middle class people who participate in the funding of campaigns. Because, you know, while you know, upper middle class people might think it's not so much to give $100 to a congressional candidate or $100 to support a presidential candidate, for most people, that's a lot of money. And if the only people you're actually able to connect to are the people who can afford a $100 contribution to a political campaign, you're excluding the vast majority of Americans from the process of funding elections. So I would love to see New York City or in New York State and, frankly, the whole nation adopt a system that included more people in funding. But certainly the New York reform, the matching fund reform, is a step in the right direction.
Mike writes to us on Twitter to say the solution would be quite simple, and it works elsewhere. Limit campaigning for any election to 6 weeks before the election or primary day, and limit campaign spending to more than 2 times the salary of the position that is being run for. That's from Mike. What do you think, Professor?
Well, there's a lot of simple solutions that we could adopt if we didn't have the constitutional restraints that the Supreme Court says we have. So both of those solutions are plainly unconstitutional under the interpretation of the First Amendment the Supreme Court has given us. And when you start talking about amending the First Amendment or passing amendments to change the protections of the First Amendment, right away you start splitting the base even on the left. So, you know, the ACLU would be vehemently opposed to the idea of amending the First Amendment to give the government the power to limit spending. And so that's why my own view has been, let's not focus so much on how to restrict and instead focus on how to enable more people to participate in the funding of campaigns so that politicians are able to respond to more people rather than responding to the tiny fraction of the 1% who fund their campaigns now.
Let me get also Michael, who writes to the program, different Michael. Michael writes an email to the program saying, he says, "We don't have sensible gun control because the NRA buys votes. Agree or disagree?" Professor?
Oh, I certainly agree. I think it's not just buying votes, and I wouldn't quite put it as buying votes, but it's certainly the ability to turn out an energized base, as well as leverage that with the money. And they've spent an enormous amount of money and been able to block reform, even though, you know, the vast majority of Americans would support sensible gun reform.
You know, and I want to kind of broaden the conversation as well to some of the themes that your recent book picks up on, which is not just money in politics, but the way money can influence so many other parts of American life. And there's a section of the book that reminded me in some ways of what Andrew Ross Sorkin wrote about, I think it was Andrew Ross Sorkin, when he was writing Too Big to Fail, for why Wall Street gets away with so much. And that's that the regulators are poorly paid. So Sorkin said that, you know, the top minds and the top sort of the talent goes to get the huge salaries on Wall Street, and kind of the also-rans, no offense, go regulate because it's paid a whole heck of a lot less. Well, here's Ornstein in the New York Times review of your book on sort of a similar subject. He writes, quote, "Some of Lessig's toughest words are for his own profession, the law. Lawyers used to prosecute white-collar crime without partisanship or other biases. But somehow, in the aftermath of the catastrophic financial crisis in 2008, not a single individual miscreant was brought to the bar of justice. Why? Start with the fact that the gap between the incomes of prosecutors and lawyers and firms has ballooned. A prosecutor now struggles for a good life relative to his or her law school colleagues in the private sector. That has led to a revolving door between prosecutors' offices and white-collar defense firms. Being hireable means public officials can't be too hard on firms they might eventually want to join." End quote. That's not just a hypothetical. You really see that, huh? The lack of an interest in really pursuing justice in cases like this.
Absolutely. I mean, that particular chapter about the law was inspired by a really fantastic book by Jesse Eisinger called The Chicken Club. But this book paints this extraordinary picture of the evolution of the life of prosecution, which, you know, used to be pretty vigorously focused on prosecuting white-collar crime. You know, Republicans and Democrats both were eager to support prosecution of white-collar crime. Republicans because these were kind of the violators of their ideal of the free market, and Democrats because they thought it was causing great harm. But the slow evolution, or not so slow evolution, what's striking is how quickly it's happened, of a Justice Department eager to prosecute and prosecute executives and send executives to jail, as happened after the savings and loan crisis, has evolved into a system where nobody wants to get anybody too upset, because so many people in the Justice Department or in prosecutors' offices are looking for their next job. They're looking for their next job in a white-collar defense firm, and the easiest way to get that is to be is to have behaved in ways that makes you an ally as opposed to an opponent. You know, Jack Abramoff, who was one of the most famous, maybe infamous, lobbyists on Capitol Hill, is a man who I've gotten to know and I have great affection for, partly because of his work to help us understand the corruption of Washington. But Jack Abramoff would say his most effective technique as a lobbyist was that when he would walk into a senator's office and he would say to the chief of staff, "So, John, what are you going to be doing in 4 years after you're finished here?" And the chief of staff would say, "I don't know, Jack." And Abramoff would say, "Well, I want you to look me up when you're finished here." And Abramoff says, "From that moment on, I owned that chief of staff, and not a single dollar had traded hands." And the point is, in a world where you know they depend on you, all you've got to do is to make them aware that you're watching. And once you make them aware you're watching, then they're going to behave in ways that keep you happy because they want you to be happy when they need a job in the future. And I think that in the prosecution, and white-collar prosecution especially, the fact that we've not paid prosecutors enough to keep them committed to a life as a prosecutor, which, you know, is a very honorable profession for many, many people for many years, means that we render ourselves vulnerable to this very ordinary kind of, again, not evil corruption, this kind of normal corruption of incentives that get produced by the gap between the pay that lawyers get outside and the gap that they get from the government.
Yeah, I felt the same way about regulators. After, you know, sort of sifting through the detritus of the 2008 crash, I found myself thinking, well, I don't mind if my tax dollars pay regulators a whole lot more. I want the top people in their sort of kind of keeping eye to make sure that this can't happen again. It nearly crashed the entire world. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I think that we've got a real problem in America. This is ultimately the end of my book that I didn't expect to conclude because I didn't start the book thinking this was the core problem. But at the end of the book, I really came around to recognizing the corrupting influence of economic inequality in the system, because every one of the problems I'm talking about is driven by the strong desire of the well off to do even better. And you know, so nobody would look at the amount of money that a prosecutor is paid. You know, it was probably 3 or 4 times the average salary of Americans, and say that they're not being well paid. But the point is understanding not whether they're well paid or not. It's just what are their incentives, recognizing that the people they went to school with are paid 10 times what they're being paid. And the same thing in the SEC or in these rating agencies. When you have these people who look to, you know, their colleagues or people they went to business school with who are being paid 10 times what they're being paid, it obviously affects how they think about their own work and what they think their future is going to look like. And if we're not willing to invest enough to make sure that our government officials are focused on the keeping their eyes on the ball, then we're going to get inept, corrupt, misguided government officials. You know, in Singapore, ministers get paid $1 million a year, ministers in the government. And you might think, wow, that's just way too much. But the thing you know is that if you're being paid that amount of money, you're not going to be worried so much about being corrupt because the incentive has been taken care of. Now, I don't think we should pay anybody that much in government in America. I think government service should be something of a sacrifice. But we need to be realistic about what kind of sacrifice it is. And if it's too great, then people psychologically start justifying to themselves the slights and the corruptions that eventually make it so the government can't actually do its job.
My guest is Harvard Law Professor Lawrence Lessig, author and one of the country's leading public intellectuals, who is coming to SUNY Geneseo tomorrow for their Open Education Week. His talk tomorrow night, 7:30 p.m. at the Wadsworth Auditorium on Geneseo's campus. It's a free talk, open to the public. And after we take our only break of the hour, I've got some more of your emails to read from listeners who've been kind of wanting to weigh in or further question some of what they're hearing from our guest on the subjects of campaign finance, money and the pernicious power of money in our politics, and what to do about all of that. You can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections at WXXI.org. We are right back. Coming up in our second hour, Duke Professor Sarah Bermeo joins us. She's in Rochester as a guest of the World Affairs Council Rochester chapter. She's talking about whom the United States decides to help with foreign aid and whom we do not help. It's an important question because in some ways, it defines what your strategy is. Are you simply helping countries that will vote with you at the UN? Or do you want development for the sake of stability and security? That's next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson with Harvard Law Professor Lawrence Lessig. And Angela writes to the program to say, Evan, I'm sorry, did your guest just say that Jack Abramoff is one of the good guys now? Is this the same Jack Abramoff I remember with the cowboy hat and everything? Go ahead. You can answer Angela's question, Professor.
Well, you know, Jack Abramoff had a pretty steep fall, and he spent a significant amount of time in a federal penitentiary. And when he came out, I think he was a different person from who he was when he went in. So I got to know him a little bit after he came out, and, you know, he's obviously had a lot of crimes to account for. But I think that his focus in helping people understand the way this corruption works is helpful. So, you know, I'm happy to see rehabilitated people and praise them for their rehabilitation.
How much do you, this is a similar question that a lot of people have been wrestling with in the last week about how much do you trust the testimony of Michael Cohen? Because when people are sort of motivated, when they're going to prison, they want to rehabilitate their image, and clearly they have lied or dissembled before, how much can you trust them now? How much do you trust Jack Abramoff and what you've learned from him?
Well, you know, obviously you've got to be skeptical, but then you've got to ask, well, what's the motive? Mm-hmm. So in Jack Abramoff's case, you know, the accounts that he's providing, he has no incentive to lie about. He's just helping us understand the way the system works. And so I don't have any doubt about that. Michael Cohen's a harder case because obviously, you know, he's trying to paint a particular picture of himself in relation to the president. And he's got a book that will apparently fill out that sketch. So you absolutely should take what he says with a grain of salt and then ask the question, well, what's the evidence that he has to back up what he says? Because, of course, it's not just he said, it's he said, and here's what you can see based on the evidence that I have. And adding those all up, I think it's a different story about his credibility than just from his words alone.
Andrew writes to the program and says, Evan, this sounds a little bit like too much of the both sides-ism that pervades the media. Your guest is upset with politicians of all stripes, including Democrats. I'm sorry, but Democrats are doing a lot more to change the system than Republicans, and I think that should at least be acknowledged. That's from Andrew. Yeah, why don't you hit that, Professor? Because clearly I know you've been frustrated with presidential contenders and members of Congress on this issue. Go ahead.
Well, I have no doubt. And it's absolutely true that the Democrats have been the ones pushing the reform, especially of campaign funding right now. And so H.R. 1, which John Sarbanes, a Democrat from Maryland, has been shepherding, you know, literally for the last decade. And now Nancy Pelosi has made the number one issue, the number one bill that they introduced in Congress and will vote on. That reform is the most important political reform I think we've seen since the Voting Rights Act of 1965. So I'm happy to praise the Democrats about this. But I think it's not true to say that the influence of money is an influence that is affecting Republicans alone. That's just not the case. It's certainly the case that Democrats also, especially in the Congress, under the existing system, have to bend and weave based on what they know will happen in the fundraising campaign as a function of the particular decisions that they make. And so if they recognize, like Republicans should, that they're being affected by this, then I think they too should have a responsibility for rallying to do something about it. And I've been completely excited and open about how great the Democrats in H.R. 1 have been. But this is not an issue that started with Donald Trump. This has been an issue that's been there for a long time. And the most frustrating thing about, you know, the last presidential election for me was, again, neither candidate made it clear, neither Democratic candidate made it clear how we could fix this system. Instead, they, you know, were happy to talk about the things that you know, sounded good, sounded cheap, like amending the Constitution, when they knew that, you know, the chances of getting an amendment through this Congress are absolutely negligible.
And I think it is worth reminding our listeners, if they missed it, you know, that at the very least, there were a lot of voters who did want to see you get on the debate stage early in the primary process. And it didn't seem that the Democratic Party wanted you on that stage, did they?
Well, no. They told me, or they told my campaign manager, they didn't want me on that stage. And when I qualified, according to their rules, the rules evolved to make it so that I couldn't qualify. Now, you know, I think it was worth it to make that run, to have the chance to be able to put this issue at the center of the debate, because I think that the Democratic Party was in the best position to rally around this issue. And it's really astonishing to me that by the time of the election in November of 2016, many Americans thought that the corrupt candidate in that race was Hillary Clinton and not Donald Trump. And that was partly because Donald Trump had grabbed the corruption issue and made it central to his campaign. And Bernie Sanders had beaten up Hillary, calling her essentially corrupt Hillary, which was Donald's shorthand for her. And she had been so timid in advancing and offering a vision of how she was going to bring about change of the corrupted system, almost like she was embarrassed by the system. Well, we all should be embarrassed by the system. We all should look at the system and say it's a terrible system. But if we don't have the courage to say it's a terrible system and here's what we can do, actually do to fix it, then we're never going to see the leadership necessary to bring about that change.
Let me get Robert in Fairport on the phone next with Harvard Law Professor Lawrence Lessig. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. There's just so much money flowing from all parties in this that, you know, I think that a lot of what you hear tends to be it's just corporations that are doing this. But if you look at the list here, and this is a list compiled by the by the Joint Commission on Public Ethics in New York State, and this is from January to June 2018, if you're looking at the top four or five lobbyists, number one is 1199 SEIU, $3.6 million, Greater New York Hospital Association, $2.3 million, Nurses Association, $1.4 million, Uber, I guess we know why we got Uber now, 1.3 million. Laborers, Employees, Cooperation and Education Trust, 1.1 million. This is designed to change votes. I mean, they're basically buying votes, and it's a lot of labor unions involved in this.
Robert, thanks for the phone call. Go ahead, Professor.
Well, I certainly think that, you know, at least at the level of super PAC or PAC spending, labor unions have a big role to play. For lobbying at the federal level, it's a different picture. Not so much, I agree, at the state level, that's a fair characterization. At the federal level, though, labor lobbying is about no more than 5% of total lobbying spending. And so it's certainly below what you would think the proportion should be, assuming that it was reflecting the actual numbers of people in the political system. But again, I'm not eager to see a different rule for labor than for anybody else. I think we ought to have a system for funding elections that gives citizens the control, not labor unions, not business PACs, not super PACs, not super rich, but, you know, ordinary citizens. And so, again, if you gave vouchers to everybody and candidates were worried about how to raise money from ordinary citizens, they could listen to the argument of corporate PACs, they could listen to the argument of labor unions, but they wouldn't be dependent on them in making their decision about who they're going to support or what proposals they're going to push.
I think the voucher idea is an interesting one. And, you know, like any idea that is going to be a significant change in a system, it's valuable to think about, well, how might this be circumvented or abused? And there are so many cynics when it comes to money in politics. I've talked to people who say, look, I hate the current system, but you know what? Every time we try to change it, McCain-Feingold, whatever the case may be, you're never going to be able to create a system that's not gameable in some way, that there's always going to be dark influence, the way money moves around, et cetera. And I think in some ways that makes the perfect the enemy of the good, and I'm not sure that that's valuable, but I also think it is fair to ask, if we go to this system that the congressman has brought up that you support, how do you see it possibly corruptible if people are getting these vouchers? You know, could they sell the voucher? I mean, what kind of comes to mind as possible corrupting influences there?
Well, I agree that the changes we've seen so far haven't worked and trigger lots of cynicism because they haven't worked. But all of the changes we've seen so far has been reform on the cheap. It's been an attempt to get rid of corruption by basically telling different groups that they couldn't participate. So you're trying to silence soft money. You're trying to limit the amount the corporations can participate. It's all these ways to just say no. And what that does is give people incentives to find other ways to bring the money into the system, because the Congress people are still so dependent on the rich participating in the funding of their campaigns, whether directly in contributions or indirectly through super PACs or independent political action committees. What we have not tried is to change the way we fund campaigns. So that's what vouchers would do. You know, for every president between Nixon and Obama funded their campaigns through presidential public funding. Now, that kind of public funding is different from vouchers. It was basically, once you qualified, you got a check. And that's not what I'm advocating for members of Congress. But it is important to recognize how different the world was. So when Ronald Reagan ran for re-election in 1984, he attended 8 fundraisers. When Barack Obama ran for re-election, he attended 228 fundraisers. So, you know, you might think, how does the president of the free world, you know, the most important man in our government, actually do his job if he's spending all the time raising money? But that's what the system requires when you take away public funding in the system. So as much as I think it would be great to solve this at the presidential system again, the more important place to solve it, the thing we have not yet tried, that we came very close to trying in the 90s, and actually the Democrats blocked it in the 90s, is public funding of congressional campaigns. And that's the issue that you can tell differentiates a credible reformer from a fake reformer. If you're not willing to talk about funding congressional campaigns differently, you're not serious about changing this corrupt system.
So what is it, though, that is going to actually move the needle? Because, you know, I suspect, Professor, if we went back the better part of a decade or more and told you that in 2019 we'd be sitting here with essentially no change, status quo entrenched, that it would be very frustrating, but maybe not totally surprising. But how do you do that? I mean, we don't really have political leaders at the very, very top calling for this. We've got some members of Congress, not a whole lot. How are you going to get this done in a system this big?
Okay, but first, I'm incredibly optimistic.
You are?
About, first of all, the public's understanding of this issue. Hmm. You know, when I first started talking about this a dozen years ago, most people were incredibly, confused about why this was an important issue. I remember people pushing climate change legislation. Thought, you know, we don't have to worry about money in politics. We'll just get a Democratic control of Congress and then we'll pass climate change legislation. And what we know now is that people on the right and the left are fundamentally frustrated with the corruption of the system, and they attribute the corruption to the corrupting influence of money in politics at numbers above 80%. And there's no difference between Republicans and Democrats about that. So that's real progress. When the people get it, and the people are deeply frustrated, and the people are demanding something, and it might be the one issue that all of us agree on, that is an extraordinary opportunity for leadership. Now, the depressing part of the story is exactly what you said. We don't have any leaders yet who are standing up and saying, look, we might differ about single-payer health care. We might differ about climate change legislation. We have all sorts of fights about immigration. These are all our differences. But let's start with the one thing we all agree on, that this is a corrupted government that we have to change if we're going to get anything else serious done. And so, you know, as depressing as it is to recognize that we still don't have a presidential candidate who is making this central, I think we have the environment where such a candidate could be enormously successful if he or she did that. And so that gives me endless optimism that maybe one of them will.
Okay. And before we lose the hour with you, just want to turn to a couple of other subjects that you've written about in your latest book, again, on the influence of money, but even beyond politics, in healthcare, in other sectors. There's been a lot of discussion in the last several years about neoliberalism, about the commodification of just about everything from education, healthcare, and more in a society that seems to prize markets over all else. I'm curious now if you can elaborate on if you think those critiques have been not only fair, but if they're now bearing fruit in terms of the public understanding and what we might do about it.
I think the critiques are fair, but I sometimes think they go too far. You know, I think the problem, certainly the problem that I was writing about, is not a problem inherent to the idea of free markets. It's the problem inherent in the idea of corrupted markets. So crony capitalism, which is the way conservatives talk about the corruption that I'm talking about, corrupts both our government and corrupts capitalism. You know, when capitalists can go to government and get protection so that they can't be defeated in the marketplace, that both weakens our government and it also weakens the marketplace. So in the areas that I'm talking about, I point to the corruptions of the system that produce the bad results that I think we all should agree would be bad results. What follows from that, I think, is at least, or maybe at most as a first step, let's fix the corruption. And let's see how far we can go in a competitive free market system without that corruption. Now, many people come back and say, well, it's unavoidable. You know, we will always have corruption. But the reality is the rules were different. And when they were different, we saw different results. So, you know, between 1950 and 1975, we had an economy where everybody was getting better off. The middle class improved just like the rich, just like the poor. And that economy allocated resources in a way that respected that equality of benefits. The rules changed, and changed in large part because of the corrupting influence of money in politics. And we had a very different economy then. And so I would love to just get to the place where we could remove the corruption and get back to a place where the economy could work and see how much good we get out of that. And if it doesn't work, if that's not enough, if we still have extraordinary poverty or hopelessness inside of our society, I'm all for thinking about what other changes we need to make. But let's start with the obvious, easy ones first and see how much we can get from that.
Down to our last minute. Soon we're going to sit down with a new member of Congress, Joe Morelli, who was elected last year to fill the seat of longtime member of Congress, Louise Slaughter, who passed away. And I will pose some of your ideas on congressional reform, campaign finance reform, to the member of Congress who's generous with his time with us. And Larry, I'm going to predict that he's going to say, look, nobody loves having to raise money, but it's not as much as people say. That's overblown. I don't know if he'll say that, but I've heard other members of Congress say we're overblowing the problem. We're not actually sitting on the phone all day. You know, so what would you ask members of Congress, especially freshman members of Congress, who are seeing that system up close for the first time?
I don't care how much time he's spending on the phone. I care who he's raising his money from. And if he's telling me he's raising his money from the tiniest fraction of the 1%, and he tells me he's a human being, those two facts together mean he's bending in the way he thinks about the nature of the problem to respond to the people who are helping him. That is human nature. And so I think we ought to respect human nature and change the system, even if it's only 20% of his time. Still, 20% of his time is a huge amount relative to the problems that we as a nation need our congressmen to solve.
Harvard Law Professor Lawrence Lessig, author of a number of books, including America Compromised, Republic Lost, one of the country's leading public intellectuals, and coming tomorrow to SUNY Geneseo for their Open Education Week, 7:30 p.m. at the Wadsworth Auditorium, a talk free and open to the public. I greatly appreciated the time. Thank you for the time, the generous time you have with us. We'll be following your work, and we'll see you here at Geneseo. Thank you so much, Professor.
Thank you.
Professor Lawrence Lessig. All right, short break. More connections coming up.